Good afternoon, members. We're going to try our best to make the trains run on time here. So the train is going to leave the station right now. And I'm calling to order the Health and Human Services Finance Division. And we have the minutes of the previous meeting in your packet.
So moved.
Oh, I see Representative Hamilton has them, is moving approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes as written, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you, members. Okay, so on the agenda today, we're going to go into our presentation overview from the Department of Human Services. But before we, there was nothing else we had to do before that, right? But we do have Commissioner Tony Laurie is here to say hello, introduce himself to us. If for those of us who might not know him, and just say a few words at the outset of this presentation. So welcome, Commissioner Laurie. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. It is great to join you from this side of the table. It's a little odd to come to a legislative hearing where the men aren't all in ties. It's sort of a rule where I come from, but it's okay, Representative Baker. This is what it's like over here, and I'm going to have to get used to this. But it truly is a real honor and a trust placed in me to serve the people of Minnesota from this position, and that's going to be my focus at all times. And you know, Governor Walz and his and Peggy Flanagan, who I know you guys all know intimately, are really serious about the vision for One Minnesota, where we bring people to the table. Voices that often haven't been heard. We really have a lens on equity and trying to, you know, make sure that everyone has a fair shot and a fair chance to, you know, find the paths to their best life. And that these are broad goals that I know that we all share. And if we can have a civil and fact-based dialogue to try to get to those ends, I'm just so excited about the opportunity to work with you. I mean, there are so many areas that we can do so much good for the people of Minnesota. Health and Human Services, the Department of Human Services is the largest agency in the state. It is a little awe-inspiring how much resources we push out onto the street of Minnesota, and we really need every year, and we need to focus on trying to make those investments by health of our people, our families, and our communities. Every single community across the state has tremendous strengths, and we need to find those strengths, and every community has gaps and needs, and we need to leverage those strengths and have them, the communities help us to fill those gaps, and that's the lens that we need to look in, and we do that through the One Minnesota vision where we bring people to the table. I have had several forums with the phenomenal employees over the Department of Human Services who will be here to offer you technical assistance in bringing your bills forward in ways that work within the structure of our current statutory framework and budgetary framework, help understand how they will play out. And I will say something I said from my role in the Senate all the time. Once we get towards the end of the day, we will have a three-way conversation in conference committee. The House will have a set of positions, the Senate will have a set of positions, and the governor will have a set of positions. And Minnesota is better off if we bring all kinds of good ideas into that. And so I want to pledge to you that our agency is at your call. We have a new legislative director here. She'll probably introduce herself to you, Alexis Russell. She's been around the Capitol several times. You'll get to know her. You can reach the Department of Human Services staff through her that will offer that technical assistance. But just I'll leave it at that because I know the smart folks that know the financial overview and can step you through where we're at and understand the structure of our budget and get you off on the right foot in terms of crafting your vision. And I just can't wait to roll out this process, work collaboratively together, and do better for the people of Minnesota.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. And I just would say that One difference with the Senate is that, of course, we just went through an election, and so we have a number of new members on the committee that probably don't know you or that you don't know and that your staff doesn't know. So I would just, you know, point that out. We're not all sort of coming in the same place, so I just want to make that note. The other thing is that it's my intention to the greatest degree possible to have this not just be a three-way conversation at the end, but to do our work in committee so that we actually have all the voices of the people who you see sitting around the table and whoever isn't here yet are going to be involved, so that we're going to have hopefully well-vetted policy, well-vetted positions that we bring to the conference committee, thereby hopefully involving a lot more than just, you know, what has sometimes been a rather closed process at the end where, you know, things happen that most of the members don't even really know about. So we're hoping to improve that process by actually having our behinds in the chair here in committee and doing the work here in committee. So thank you very much, and
thank
we look
you.
Forward to working with you.
Thank you.
And with that, we will move on to the overview and welcome to the committee. And please go ahead and state your name or your names, whoever's going to present, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Alex Kutz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Dave Greenman. I'm the Budget Director with the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for having us here today. As you see in your packet, we have a lot of slides. We took the opportunity to really share some of the work that we do, and as Commissioner Lori said, kind of all the funding that we're interested with, and to give you a little information about that. We're going to tag team, since it is a long presentation. I'll do some sections, and Mr. Greenman will do others.
Very good. And as we get started, too, I guess I would remind members that I think the most efficient way to do this is to hold our questions at least till the end of a section, and maybe you can tell us when a section is done and when questions might be welcomed, unless, of course, members, if there's something that you need urgently in order to understand what's being said, like what is that acronym or what is that, what slide are we on, something like that. And hopefully we can move through expeditiously. Thank you. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So first, I wanted to start by giving you some context. This slide shows total all funds of the enacted budget for 2018 and 2019. For the state, it's $84.1 billion. And what you see on here, that Health and Human Services, which includes our agency, Department of Human Services, but it also includes Health, Minnesota Department of Health, accounts for 42% of all the state spending, including both the federal funds and the general fund. One reason why DHS is such a large part of the all funds budget is because we receive a lot of federal funding. So in fiscal year 18-19, DHS projected to receive about $19.2 billion in federal funds, including TANF, which is a temporary assistance for needy families. The vast majority of our federal funding is the federal match on medical assistance, or what we call MA. So next slide. Okay. The next slide. So in contrast to that, we're 42% of all state, all fund spending. This slide shows just the general fund. So the general fund for the state is about $45.9 billion, and human services drops to number two. We're 30% of that. K-12 education is the top one at 41%. And I just wanted to show that contrast because that just demonstrates that a lot of our funding comes from federal sources. Okay, so now getting to what do we spend at the Department of Human Services. Our all funds actual fiscal year 18, so I'm switching to talking about what did we actually spend in state fiscal year 18 budget is $17.8 billion. This slide shows the breakdown by fund. So you see the 52.1% on federal funding. That's, again, what I showed you before. That's why we make up a larger part of the all funds for the state. And then we also have the general fund at 35.3%, Special revenue funds, which include things like our licensing division and other fee-based programs, is 4.4%. And then other, which includes mostly our enterprise funds, which are both the chemical dependency treatment program within our direct care and treatment, I'll talk more about that later, and the Minnesota State Operated Community Services program. They're both larger enterprise funds within that other. Also included in other, just kind of technical, but child support enforcement and medical assistance administration are included in there. These are pass-through dollars that we take in as a state and then pass them through to a parent or through to counties and other partners. And so we don't actually account for them as funding that comes to the state. It's a pass-through, and we use that those mechanisms, that other fund, to do that. This is the same $17.8 billion, but now broken down by program. So when we talk about all of that money, the vast majority of the spending is in medical assistance. So 71% of that $17.8 billion is spent on MA. Next is Children and Family Services. That's 8%, and that includes our cash assistance programs, things like SNAP, that and MFIP, like cash programs and child care, so that makes up that second bar. The other ones on here, technical and fiduciary, are both things that were in the other category, like the child support and the MA administration dollars. And then I just wanted to point out also direct care and treatment makes up 3% of our total funds budget, but is actually more of our FTs than any other area. More of the people who work for the Department of Human Services work in that area. And we have a little section later on that talks about how many FTs and where do they work there. So all of that money, where does it come from? That $17.8 billion is funded. DHS is funded. This is, again, 2018 actual data. We're funded primarily through federal funding. 52% of our funding comes from federal statutory funding. 39% comes from all of you, from direct appropriations funding. And then the other 9% comes from other statutory funding bases, like the enterprise funds that I mentioned, where we get fees for things or where we charge. We're a provider and we charge for them. So that was the high-level kind of overview section. Next, Mr. Greenman's going to talk about DHS numbers and FTs, kind of walk you through our budget structure. Madam Chair, I can take any questions now on that section.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for members? Okay, and you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes I forget my question if I don't ask it right away, so I would encourage you to jot it down as we go if you do come up with anything. Anybody? Okay. Don't see any right now. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think we're going to pivot away from the PowerPoint for just a minute. I think you all received two additional documents in your packet. One is called refers to the fiscal year 2020 DHS budget structure. I thought I would just talk a little bit about what the department's budget structure looks like. So this is what Mr. Berg uses when he's appropriating our funds or putting the bill together, ultimately to appropriate our funds. As you can see from looking at this document right here, there are several programs that we use. We budget at the program and then the budget activity level. We have several programs, including Program 10 is our central office. Program 20 is our forecasted programs. Those include like medical assistance and MFIP and the other programs that are forecasted through the department and also appropriated through the legislature. We have grant programs. We have a number of different grant programs that are covered under Program 40. And then direct care and treatment is in Program 60. Ms. Kutza talked about the next two as being in the other category. Fiduciary activities is Program 80. That's the program that where we primarily that's all child support money, where money flows through from child support collections and goes to the obligee parents. And then the final one is technical activities, and these are primarily areas where we're collecting federal funds through administrative reimbursement. So either collecting them on behalf of the department or on behalf of counties or other state agencies. And so that's where that budgeting takes place. And then underneath within each program, there are specific budget activities. Like, for example, budget activity 21 is the MFIP DWP, or Diversionary Work Program. That's how Mr. Berg appropriates the funds. So he'll appropriate them in the spreadsheet as any appropriation for that activity will be noted as with a 21 in the tracking spreadsheet, and that explains where the money's going once it gets appropriated into the department. And so that's how that works when you're doing the budgeting. So that just so you know what to expect when you see a spreadsheet. The next document is basically our budget for fiscal year 18 and 19. It's a spreadsheet. It's the biennial expenditures for fiscal year 18 and projected expenditures for fiscal year 19 based on the forecast. What you can see is that the money shows the expenditures by the budget activity. So for each budget activity, you can see how much is spent from the general fund, the healthcare access fund, other funds. The first set of columns is the direct appropriated budget. These are the dollars that you directly appropriate to us. So the general fund is obviously the biggest one there, but you also see healthcare access fund spending, federal TANF dollars. Even though these are federal dollars, they are direct appropriated by the legislature. So that's where those dollars come from, and they primarily go to the MFIT program and then also to grants for employment services. Other direct appropriated areas include the state government special revenue fund. This is a small, for us at least, for DHS at least, it's a small fund. This is where we collect licensing fees, and then you all set the fee amounts, and then you appropriate those dollars out to us, and we spend those dollars to do the licensing work. And so that's where that works. The lottery, there's a very small amount of lottery prize money that gets appropriated by the legislature to the department for certain programs. And then in the statutory budget, these are areas of the budget where we have statutory authority that you all have given us to spend money. It's often there'll be maybe setting up dedicated funds where we'll collect certain amounts of revenue or certain revenue flows into a certain fund, and it's statutorily appropriated to the department to be used for certain purposes. Let's see, for example, the minute system, the systems fund that DHS has is a statutory appropriated fund. So then there's a number of other statutory budget funds, the largest of which is the federal fund. You can see medical assistance is the largest in the forecasted programs, $14 billion in fiscal years 18 and 19. You can also see some large numbers of federal funds in the grants program area. In particular, I point out the $926 million, which is for the SNAP program. We spend over $900 million every 2 years on the SNAP program. So that's sort of how the budget looks from a high level from a spreadsheet. I wanted to just kind of give you a sense of where that is. And I'm happy to answer questions on that, or we can go back to the PowerPoint.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. I do have something that I think would be helpful for members, because if you all know this, I don't mean to, there's a lot of stuff I didn't know and that I'm still learning. This is incredibly complicated, so I'm sorry if I'm going to kind of assume, and I like our testifiers to assume, that we know very little or nothing, because I think that often that's the case. We can never hear it too many times. It's very complicated. Could you just explain to members the difference between a forecasted program and one that is, what's the opposite of that, direct appropriated, I guess. No, whatever the opposite of that would be. So I think often this is really confusing for members because we deal with both in our budget. But what does it mean when something's a forecasted program?
So what that means is that some people also refer to them as entitlement programs. It's a program where the legislature appropriates the funds. In both cases, the legislature will appropriate funds, both for the forecasted programs and the non-forecasted programs. Typically what happens with forecasted programs, though, is it involves, like medical assistance, for example, people who are eligible for medical assistance and need services are able to, under the rules of the program, within the rules of the program, are able to get services and spend money, and we make payments to the health plans and to the providers to pay for their services, and we project every with every forecast in November and February, we project how much we think is going to be spent on those programs under current law, and come back to the legislature and say, this is how much we think we're going to spend. And the legislature typically either appropriates the money to cover those costs or we have to make changes to the program to stay within the appropriations. And typically they just appropriate money to keep the program operating as it currently is in statute. For the non-forecasted programs, these are generally grants and central office type of activities where you give us a certain amount of money and we have to spend within that limit. We can't go beyond that limit. For forecasted programs, if it looks like we're going to go above what you've appropriated for us, we come back with a forecast adjustment legislation to adjust what's actually being spent based on what's in the forecast. So I'm not sure if that explains it or not, but.
Well, let's find out. I mean, does anybody have questions based on that? So when we have the quiz, everybody's going to know the difference. Are you raising your hand?
I'm good.
Okay. Okay. So, I mean, I think it's really important for members to understand this, and it'll probably become clearer, hopefully, as we go on here. But I guess I would somewhat summarize that by saying in a forecast program, the legislature sets the rules about, who can benefit from the program and what kind of benefits they can have. But we're basically saying whoever shows up under those rules, we're going to pay for. Whereas a non-forecasted appropriation, we're going to say, here's an amount of money for a certain activity. So those things show up differently. And Mr. Greenman, you might correct me if I'm wrong, but part of our so-called surplus that we just found out about has to do with fewer people showing up for medical assistance. So the HHS budget actually produced a lot of that savings because fewer people than expected signed up for medical assistance, thereby a savings is reflected in the forecast. So,
Madam Chair, that's correct. The forecast, I think, showed an adjustment in spending on forecasted programs that was about it produced about $735 million in reduced spending from fiscal year 18 to fiscal year 21. So, yeah, that's absolutely right.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, so when there is a surplus like that, what happens to those funds? Does that stay in there and roll over, or is it absorbed into do you have to give it back? What happens to those funds?
Madam Chair, Representative, the
agreement.
The dollars get what actually happens in order to sort of put those dollars back into the general fund is the legislature passes what's called a forecast adjustment legislation, which actually reduces the appropriation to match what's in the forecast. So the forecast is assuming less spending on the medical assistance program and on the MFIP program. And what the legislature will do is based on the numbers we provide through the forecast and through what MMB provides through the forecast, we will reduce the amount of appropriation to match what's in the forecast.
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
And how often does that happen, that adjustment is done? That's the first question. And when you say the legislature does that mean like this committee gets together and does that, or is it who is responsible for making that adjustment?
Mr. Greenman.
It's typically handled in a very, it's sort of an operational or a process issue. It really just, Mr. Berg will put together an appropriate forecast adjustment article in the finance bill that that makes that adjustment. And so it happens anytime, well, it doesn't happen anytime, but it happens when you pass a finance bill at the end of the legislative session, either the biennial budget or the supplemental budget. And I would just point out this last year there was no forecast adjustment because the finance bill was vetoed.
Representative Kunesh-Podein, did you want to follow up with that? I'm not sure if you feel completely satisfied that you understand the answer, but maybe I think Representative Loeffler wanted to, did you want to shed light on this same issue,
well,
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Greenman is just a real pro, and we loved working with him when he was on the House staff helping us do the numbers, and but he, I think maybe an easier way to look at it is if you think about the discussion of the $1.5 billion quote surplus that disappears once you put inflation and other things in there, a much of it in terms of ongoing revenues. But if you think of that 1.5, when Mr. Greenman said about $700 million was not needed as they adjusted because less people needed medical assistance, maybe more people got jobs with health insurance, whatever the cause was. So they reduced the estimate of how much money would be needed in that forecasted program. Then that $700 million is reported from DHS to the MMB, our finance department, and they use that in putting together the forecast. So I like to think of it as the Health and Human Services budget contributed $700 million towards that 1.5, and it's always been my goal to say we should be rewarded when good programs help people become more self-sufficient. We get about 20% of it at least reserved for this committee, but it's never happened.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Okay, let's continue then. We can continue. Thank you.
Okay. This next slide. So we'll go back to the PowerPoint and start talking about sort of our DHS by the numbers. This next slide shows the number of FTEs at the department broken out by fund. And so as you can see, we have about 6,750 full-time equivalents at the Department of Human Services right now, and most of them, about 3,900 of them, are funded out of the general fund. We have another large number that are funded out of the Enterprise Fund, and the Enterprise Fund is essentially the way we operate a number of our direct care and treatment programs, where we collect revenues to pay for the cost of the program. The programs theoretically should be self-sufficient. They do get some appropriation from the legislature, but these are our enterprise programs that Ms. Kutz is going to talk about in a bit. But we have about 1,500 employees or 1,600 employees in our enterprise programs. We also have FTEs in our healthcare access fund, mainly in the area of our healthcare administration, and to fund some of our grant programs. The special revenue funds that have about 660 FTEs contain our licensing and background studies divisions within our operating budget. Also includes child support enforcement and healthcare operations. Minute staff is not included in this list. They're actually, obviously, from the last several years, they've been funded, or they're actually minute employees at this point. So you'll see when we look at in the next couple slides, there's a graph showing the change in total FTEs at the department over time, and you can see the reduction in FTEs due to the minute reduction.
And Mr. Greenman, just for clarity for members, when you talk about the Enterprise Fund and direct care and treatment, we're talking about facilities where the state directly has responsibility for delivering services to some of our vulnerable people, right? I just want members to be clear about this. A lot of what we do in Health and Human Services is delivering service by contracting with nonprofits and for-profits and, you know, various providers. But this is where the people delivering the care are actually state employees And we do that in, I think, as I understand it, these are kind of some of the most difficult to serve population, that it's really hard to go out and buy services for them. So we're serving them directly in these funds. And so the state bills their insurance or the Medicaid dollars go here, right? So that's why they're enterprise, because we're kind of charging for services, even though sometimes the services are paid for by us. Am I right there?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Yeah, that's how we have this next slide sort of gets at your point, which is it shows the number of FTEs that we have spread out by program area within the department. So you can see by far the largest area of our employment is in DCT. It's about 4,600 employees, and these folks are spread out at the security hospital that we have in St. Peter, sex offender programs that are in Moose Lake and St. Peter, and also the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, and also at the community behavioral health hospitals we have, and also our community services programs. And Ms. Kutz is going to kind of talk a little bit about how those folks are distributed among those programs. The two other large areas where we have FTEs are in healthcare, which includes our staff that do enrollment and renewals for our healthcare programs, and then also in operations where we have licensing, background study responsibilities. We have we're fairly heavily staffed in those areas as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask, I know that the IT employees are now under Minute IT, but how many employees deal with HHS programs?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, I believe there's about 700.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Greenman. I was kind of surprised by this chart on page 10 in that over half your budget, or about half your budget, is federal funds, and I know a lot of that is medical assistance, but I was surprised at how few of your staff are funded by federal funds. And is that a choice, or do we fully take advantage of opportunities to use federal administrative funds to cover FTEs?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, you know, we do have some staff that are funded through when we're allowed to, when the feds allow us to fund staff. I mean, we receive a lot of federal grants, and that often is that often includes some staffing. But like you said, the largest single source of funding for the agency is the medical assistance program, and we don't really have that doesn't really provide a lot of funding for staffing. We do have some federally funded staff. We can certainly provide you with more information about the number of federally funded staff that we have. But you're right; it's not a large number of people.
Representative Lott.
And just to follow up, as you follow up with that, Mr. Greenman, because if you look at the next chart on page 11, healthcare is 731 staff. So I would have thought that would be more of 50-50 kind of split. With the federal dollars. So just trying to make sure that we're maximizing our opportunities to draw down on federal dollars when we have the chance.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Greenman.
Representative Loeffler, I think a lot of the staff that are funded in the healthcare area are actually from the Healthcare Access Fund. But we can certainly look at that. I think it's definitely worth looking at.
Okay. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenman, a question on page 11, continuing care for older adults. Would that include all types of care for older adults, as far as like in-home or any funds for retirement community help?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative, the staff we're talking about work on it. They don't provide direct care. They work in an administrative capacity, administering programs. They do things like set nursing home rates, oversee the Aging and Adult Services grants. They oversee the assisted or alternative care program. So they don't actually provide direct services, but they do that administration within the department oversees nursing facilities and aging and long-term care services grants. So that's the kind of work that they do.
Okay, so the local as well. Local administering with the local communities as well as statewide retirement facilities.
Madam Chair, Representative, they do work with the local, with the counties. We in Minnesota, we have a state-supervised, county-administered human services system. So this doesn't include the county staff that actually do a lot of the local administration of the of the programs.
Thank you.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know I appreciate you were trying to explain this, and I think I still missed it. So can I ask again?
Right, all right, yeah, please.
This was a direct care and
you
treatment.
You missed it. Someone else missed it, too.
So the direct care and treatment's 3% of the overall budget spending, but 4,600 employees. And yet I was trying to follow you that you were talking about contracting, that we contract for other for those services to be delivered through other nonprofits, et cetera. So describe 4,600 employees. What are those people doing, if you can, like, give me a specific example?
Ms. Kotzia.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So the reason your question is really great. So the reason that it's only 3% of our budget is because, as Mr. Greenman mentioned, that most of our budget is spent on medical assistance. So that's such a big number that when you spend, even though it's 4,600 FTEs, when you only spend a few hundred million dollars on a program, it becomes a small percentage. But these FTEs, and later in the PowerPoint I'll go over this in detail, but these FTEs are actually nurses and security officers and medical professionals and clinical providers who work in our system, in our direct care system, providing care to over 12,000 individuals in a year, both in our hospitals like the Minnesota Security Hospital and the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, and also in our community behavioral health hospitals, in our chemical dependency treatment areas, and in group homes. We have over 120 group homes that serve over 400 people across the state. So that's where most of those, that's actual provision of service. And as Mr. Greenman mentioned previously, most of the other FTEs you see on here are administrative FTEs that work with our county and tribal and other partners to set policy and administer grants and programs.
Thank you very much.
Representative Haley. Great. Thank you for asking the question. Other questions? Okay, I think we can continue. Thanks.
So the next slide shows the changes in the total number of FTEs at the department over time since between 2013 and 2018. One of the significant things you might notice is between 2015 and 2016, there was a reduction in FTEs, and that resulted mainly from, as I mentioned before, the consolidation of IT services with Minute, and that shifted about 700 IT positions from DHS to Minute, which we now pay for. Rather than paying for those people as our as staff, we pay for Minute services as a service rather than through our payroll. And in addition to that, the other issue that went on between 15 and 16 was a temporary hiring freeze as a result of a shortfall in the DCT enterprise programs that we had to deal with that year. The increased staff from fiscal year 2017 to 2018 represents a number of factors. About 200 new FTEs were funded during the 2017 legislative session. This mainly included staff for our direct care and treatment programs, as well as our licensing programs. In addition, another 124 FTEs were funded in 2018 as a result of legislation that may have passed previously, like legislation passing in 2015 or 2016 may have funded additional FTEs to start in fiscal year 18, and we just brought those people on board over time. And then finally, there were a number of FTEs that were scheduled to start in fiscal year 17 that didn't, And that's why you see more of a jump between fiscal year 17 and 18 is because we didn't add FTEs as quickly as we thought, and so it took us a little longer, and we added those FTEs in fiscal year 18 instead. So the next slide shows our overall funding overview. As you can see, about 3% of the department's $17.8 billion budget is spent on administrative and policy staff of the department. So these staff essentially administer the other 97% of the department's budget to provide programs and services. We've been able to maintain this ratio of administrative to program funding even as we've taken on new and more complex work over the past several years, and some of that's included increased licensing work, compliance with the Jensen settlement, nursing facility payment reform, and behavioral health care homes and other types of services related to child protection as well. So that's and this gets at the what Ms. Kutza was saying earlier just about the significant amount of funding we receive from the federal government for the Medicaid program. That contributes significantly to the large green area on that chart.
Representative Hayden.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So if you take out medical assistance, how much of the DHS budget is administration?
Mr.
What percent?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'm not able to do the math quite that quickly. I know medical assistance is about $12 billion out of our $17 billion, or $17.8 billion budget. We can work on that and get that back to you.
Okay. Yes. That'd be satisfactory.
Thank you.
Just one additional question.
Oh, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, just looking at the FTEs and the increase, I know you gave a brief explanation, but generally speaking, in the private sector, technology is reducing the number of FTEs, but here we seem to be going back up in the direction we were before. Is that because there are additional people, additional caseload, additional regulations, or, you know, there's a consolidation of the IT department, which created about a little less than 800 reduction in FTEs, and now we seem to be climbing back in the same direction. So are these additional FTEs for technology reasons, for administration, or, you know, it's, what's your, I guess I'd appreciate your thoughts on that.
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'd say for the most part, I'm not sure exactly what the percentage is, but a large number of our FTEs are in the area of direct care and treatment. And over the past several years, the legislature has made some pretty significant investments to address some safety concerns and some quality of care concerns at our direct care and treatment facilities. And so I think that's where a large part of the increase you're seeing is coming from. We've also been working to address some licensing areas in the area of home and community-based services. Those activities have seen some additional staffing as well. But I would say it's primarily not related to IT.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen? Okay, please continue. Oh, I'm sorry. We've got one more, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, is the budget within DHS constrained, or do you have quite a bit of extra loose funds to use? Is it pretty tight?
Mr. Greenman or Ms. Coltsy?
Madam Chair, Representative, as Mr. Greenman mentioned, we have forecasted programs that are forecasted every November and February, which reflect current law, and then we have direct appropriations. And we are constrained by the direct appropriations that you provide to us and the intent with which they were given to us. So we stay within those funds, and anything that's remaining at the end of the year or at the end of the biennium is given back to the general fund.
Okay. Follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm kind of digging into this fraud within child care, and the department under the OIG paid for an outside asset management firm to the tune of just shy over $90,000 to investigate their own employees within the OIG department. And so I'm just kind of wondering where that fits in with, because we didn't appropriate that funding for that investigation, where those kind of loose funds come from. The firm is called PFM. It's an asset management firm.
Mr. Greenman, can you address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Branson, I think we can certainly look at where those dollars came from. I'm not sure where the decision came from. I'm not familiar with that. I mean, I'm familiar with the contract. I don't know enough about the specifics of the funding and where it came from.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Branson.
Thank you. I have some data privacy or data practice requests out that the department has been pretty slow on answering, and the information that I have received has been slim to none. So that's why I'm just putting it out on the record there. Thank you.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question. It's from earlier on the overall budget, and Representative Franzen kind of reminded me of this. That $735 million that we overtaxed, or the extra money that was left over from the HHS or the overage, is that federal dollars or is that state dollars or a mixture of them? And is there any money that's returned to the federal government if it is federal dollars?
Madam Chair, Greenman. Representative, that's all state general fund dollars. And so there's certainly, when we spend Medicaid dollars, we draw down federal funds as we need them for the match. And so we don't actually get the federal funds directly appropriated to us by the federal government. They sit in Washington, D.C., and they get pulled down as we need them to pay for our programs. And so the federal funds just aren't spent as much as, you know, it's just a less amount of spent of federal spending than we would have thought we would have needed, based on the forecast.
Okay.
And then, Representative Munson.
And Madam Chair, just one follow-up question. Who forecasted that amount that we would need? So the $735 million overage, what forecast was that? Was it put together by our fiscal staff, or is it I guess who put that together?
Who does the forecasts, Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, the department does the forecasts. I would say a couple things. I would say one is the forecast is really our best estimate of what we think is going to happen from forecast to forecast. And so essentially what happens is we look at a number of economic indicators, and we look at our enrollment in our programs and try to make the best estimate that we can of what people are going to be on our programs and how much we're going to be spending based on what we know of managed care expenditures and what we've been able to, what we found out primarily as a result of that generate a lot of the savings is number one, because of the strong economy, there's a lot fewer people on our programs. There's people, the enrollment has gone down relative to what we expected to see. And also we see that managed care rates are, that the managed care rates are less than what we had originally anticipated that they would be. So those are things, some of which you can anticipate, some of which you can't. One thing I would say about the forecast is that $735 million, I would say, probably amounts to about a 2% shift. I mean, I would say in our forecast, in defense of our folks, we come really close pretty consistently. It's just a matter of when you miss, it's because we're talking about so much money. A small miss is a large number of dollars.
Okay. And Mr. Greenman, and I want to throw this in before I call on Representative Hamilton, who's next. A forecast is a forecast. It's looking to the future and making your educated guess about what the numbers will look like. Nobody's been overtaxed to pay for it. It's a projection of, if the law stays the way it is right now, what will it look like at the end of the next biennium? And Mr. Greenman, please be ready to correct me if I misstate any of this. But so we as a legislature are going to make whatever changes we make, whether reducing or increasing taxes, whether reducing or increasing expenditures, so that when we do the actual thing in the next 2 years, we try to hit, you know, make the two numbers work out, the spending and the revenues, as close as we can. But the fact that we're projecting a surplus, it's just a point in time, really, guesstimate, although it's a very professionally done and as accurate as possible, of what we expect to see in the next 2 years. So to say that somebody's been overtaxed because there's a surplus and the number now looks better than it did at the when it was last projected, that doesn't say, as I understand the world, that doesn't say anybody's been overtaxed. And so, Mr. Greenman, is that accurate, or at least the part that's not an opinion, is that accurate?
Madam Chair, I think that's true.
Okay. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, thank you for all that you do as well. And I couldn't imagine trying to forecast dollars or programs that use this, you know, these large sums of money. But I think it would be interesting. Just take a look at what the actuals versus the forecasts over the course of time. Just see a grasp along that. See if we're conservative on our forecasts or if we're being, you know, building in additional dollars in there just to be on the safe side, if you will. Because if you take a look, I would request that we go back at least 15 years and just take a look. As Madam Chair, you've experienced this too. We've seen anywhere from $2+ billion surpluses all the way down to $5 and $6 billion deficits. And we make those decisions on spending based on those forecasts. So it'd just be interesting to see how we've done along the way between forecasts and actuals.
Yeah, and Mr. Greenman, I think we actually have done some of that. I think some of that's available. Or maybe Mr. Berg could tell us, but I'm pretty sure that we've done something like that and that it might be available for people to look at if you want to see how good have the forecasts been over time. Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if it's readily available. I know this discussion has happened before, and I believe it was Mr. Hoffman who testified at some point, who ran reports and forecasts, and testified at one point that over the long term, their forecasts are within about 3% on average. I don't know. I don't recall a publication that backs that up. I have heard that.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to be very clear. I'm not trying to be critical at all about the work that's trying to do predicting the future. I am saying it would be, I think it'd be helpful to see, just to gauge that, if you will, because we do make spending decisions based on that, right, as far as the policies that we move. And Madam Chair, I do have a second question,
yeah,
if I could.
Go ahead.
Going back to the services, excuse me, that the department is receiving from Minute now, I guess my question is, are you receiving the services that you deserve, you know? Minute has quite a few things on their plate, of course, and right now you hear a lot about MNLARS, and a lot of the effort is being focused towards there. And with that said, are you or the department able to receive the attention that you need? We just had a conversation yesterday on that the programs seem to be doing what they were designed to do, the computer programs and stuff, yet there's still a need to be able to upgrade those, I think, is what I heard. So that was a long way to get to my question. Are you receiving what you need?
I mean, you folks can try to answer if you want to, but I think we might be asking the wrong people, because I think you're asking more of a qualitative question, and these are the number crunchers. So if you want to answer, that would be fine. Otherwise, maybe you could kind of put a pin in that question and hold it for when we have – you know, I'm sure what we can hear about that, because I think technology at DHS is going to be a big issue this session, and we will be talking about it.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to put a pin in it.
Okay. Mr. Greenman or Ms. Kotza, do you want to try to respond?
Madam Chair, Representative, the only thing I would say is that the 700 people that we are talking about are dedicated Minute at DHS, or how they're talking about now. They many of them sit in our buildings and provide services to us, so it's not as if they moved somewhere else to provide services to us. I agree with the chair that we are probably not the right people to answer. We're very quantitative people, less so qualitative.
Yeah, but thanks for asking. It's good to understand that the people are still there doing the same work, but it's just that for budgeting purposes, they're in a different budget now.
Right.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Please continue.
Okay. So this next slide shows total DHS expenditure trends, all funds. And as you can see, it shows the total for fiscal year 18 of about $17.8 billion. And it shows our all fund spending going back to fiscal year 2012. As you can see, the trend is our spending is growing. The majority of the growth is in our forecasted programs, particularly the MA, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. A couple areas to point out from fiscal years 13 to 14, forecasted programs increased by about $1 billion. This was mainly due to the expansion under the Affordable Care Act in both families with children and adults without children. From 14 to 15, there was about a 9.4% increase due to forecasted programs. Much of it was in long-term care and home and community-based services, which, those areas. The reduction from fiscal years 16 to 17 results from a reduction in forecasted programs, primarily the medical assistance program. And then the largest single factor driving the growth from fiscal year 17 to 18, and you'll notice it if you kind of look at the graph long enough, is there's a managed care payment delay that happens. The last payment the odd numbered fiscal year is delayed until the beginning of even numbered years. Mm-hmm. And so you see from fiscal year 17 to fiscal year 18, you see a growth of about 1.8 billion dollars. What you're actually seeing is significantly an $800 million swing from year to year, based because of the fact that we're delaying managed care payments. The last managed care payment in fiscal year 17, or the last several, I should say, managed care payments in fiscal year 17 until fiscal year 18. So you're artificially holding down spending in fiscal year 17, and you're artificially increasing it in fiscal year 18. And you can see that happening between 15 and 16 as well, and then going on into the other years. Other factors include in the growth between 17 and 18 included about a 2% growth in MA enrollment and a 5% increase in costs between fiscal year 17 and 18. This next slide shows, it's essentially the same bars, but it shows the spending broken down between federal funds, state dollar, general fund, and all other funds. And as you can see, the largest growth is in the federal funds between fiscal years 13 and 18. The overall federal funding to the department, the federal share of overall expenditures that the department made between fiscal years 13 and 18 grew about 53% on the federal level. And a lot of this happened as a result of Medicaid expansion for adults without kids, which is, for a number of years, was 100% federally funded. General fund spending grew about 25% during that period, and all other spending grew by about 14% during that period. And the other funds are largely, these are dollars maybe that get spent. A number of our medical assistance programs or services, there's a county share for expenditures. One example is targeted case management, in which the counties draw down federal funds to pay for case management, and the county pays the non-federal share rather than the state. And so that's where we get a lot of the county
spending coming from. So the next slide is another sort of another lens of our spending between 13 and 18. You can see that, again, forecasted programs growing more quickly than other areas. Between fiscal years 14 and 18, forecasted programs grew by about 34%. Direct care spending grew by about 20%, and spending on grant programs actually decreased by 5% during that period. Now we'll switch it over to Ms. Kutza to talk about direct care and treatment.
Okay. So as we mentioned before, we want to spend a little bit of time because we do care for over 12,000 people in our system each year, and we wanted to kind of spend time showing you how this part of our budget works since we are a provider of services.
And Ms. Kutza, if I could just stop you for a second. So Sure. We're talking here, I just want to put this in perspective for members, right? We're going to focus on about 12,000 people who are directly cared for by state programs and remind us of what is the total universe of people that we serve through public programs.
Sure, Madam Chair, members. We serve about 1.1 million people in our programs across the programs, mostly in medical assistance. So it's a small percentage, right. Again, but an important one in that we're providing actual service to, as you mentioned, many people who it's difficult to find other places to care for them.
Okay, thank you. Sometimes we go through and because every slide is the same size, mm-hmm. and the bars are all this, you know, you kind of can lose perspective about what we're talking about here. So I just wanted to flag that for members that even though this is really important, we serve these people differently, that it's actually quite a small slice in terms of the number of people that we're serving. So thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. So the first bar on here, mental health and substance abuse treatment, includes our Anoka Regional Treatment Center, our community behavioral health hospitals, our child and adolescent behavioral health program that serves children and adolescents, and our intensive regional treatment centers, which are sometimes called ERTs, that also serve people in our communities. They spend about $125 million a year on those services. The community-based services bar, which spends about $123 million a year, includes the Minnesota State-Operated Community Services, I had mentioned, or MSOCs, we call it. That is the program that has about 120 group homes across the state of Minnesota that serve about 400 people each year. Also, our Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise, or CARE, is in this bar. The next bar, forensics, is $101 million a year and includes the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter, the Competency Restoration, Nursing Home and Transition Services. They're all in St. Peter, Minnesota, on our campus there. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program is at Moose Lake and St. Peter, and all of the provisional discharge for people who are on provisional discharge in the community, all of their placements, we spend about $92 million a year on that program. And then finally, direct care and treatment operations, which you're going to see in a later graph, that we recently segregated that part of our budget into a separate budget activity that Mr. Greenman had talked about earlier on that sheet. If you had looked at that sheet a few years back, we wouldn't have had a direct care and treatment operations budget activity. It was embedded in a different area, but to increase transparency, we wanted to separate that out. That includes many things that you don't see in a normal and in a regular office, like medical director, medical records, finance facilities. We have a lot of buildings in this area. So those are the main drivers of that cost.
And Ms. Kutza, that reminds me, so when we're looking at these numbers, we're talking about direct care and treatment. We're not talking just about the people that we hire to provide services. We're also talking about the facilities, right, and the linens and the medications and all of the things that it takes to support someone in a facility, or some of these are outpatient, I realize, but,
right.
You know, but it's all of the costs of doing that.
Right, Madam Chair, that includes absolutely the things you're saying, including dietary and other services that you wouldn't have in a traditional office setting. This is a direct care setting, so we also employ people who do that type of work.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this looks at expenditure trends in direct care and treatment, and it's broken down by that same group, mental health and substance disorder treatment. They finally call it MSATs, not sure why. And then CBS, Forensics, Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and the operations. What I guess I wanted to point out a couple things here is Mr. Greenman mentioned over the past couple legislative sessions, the legislature made a pretty significant investment in direct care and treatment, particularly in our mental health and substance abuse treatment areas, which is the bottom section of the graph, and then also in forensics. So you see that reflected here as the numbers go up. You also see that a lot of our administrative dollars were in the MSATs area, that bottom section, and so when we broke those out, that also decreased that section of this graph. So MSOCs that I mentioned is in that green community-based services. That will staff based on who is in their program. They're an enterprise program that gets revenue in for caring for clients. They also have an appropriation in there that the legislature gave them, but they staff based on their how many people are in their homes and what is needed.
And Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in terms of the group homes that you're operating for people with a variety of disabilities, I'm assuming that that falls under the Olmstead court case and the plan, and is that evolving and changing as we're looking at moving people with disabilities into more independent situations, getting them more integrated into the more normal community living, work opportunities kind of realm?
And Representative Loeffler, again, this might really be outside their
okay,
their area, but, you know, Ms. Coates.
Well, I just wondered if it's changing what and how they're doing.
Yeah, if you want to try to answer that, otherwise we'll, you know.
Madam Chair, Representative, what I would say is many of the clients who come into those facilities are coming from one of our larger institutional type, like ANOCA or MSH. Many of those folks are coming to then a community-based home setting, which is more Olmstead-like. But, yes, I would defer to more experts in the clinical field to answer about how they've changed their business practices and what how we deliver care based on Olmstead.
Thank you.
Representative Munson.
Hi, I'm sorry, I was trying to follow along in the charts here. Can you explain the explosive growth in the operations budget? And if you covered it, I apologize for not paying attention, but it went from looking at the chart here,
what
I think it's still on the screen, on page 20 where it looks like it goes from 3 million, you know, consistently 2 million and then to 44 million. What was the reason?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. The issue was a couple of years ago we actually worked with the legislature to break that cost out. Previously, we had a small piece of it, as you see here, of the Direct Care and Treatment Administration that was budgeted for things like finance people and very administrative, but our overall medical administration, our medical records, our facilities management was actually embedded in mental health. So you see that bottom bar in 17 as $151 million, then goes to $124 million. What we did was break out a lot of staff that was being accounted for there that wasn't really providing services at those facilities. They were overseeing all of the medical records, all of the medical administration, all of the facilities for all of direct care and treatment, and we put them in their own budget activity to be more transparent about how much do we spend on administration of the direct care and treatment programs.
Representative Munson.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So there was a significant growth, if I'm doing the math correctly, going from $151 million to $124 million. Isn't just shifting the numbers up there, is it?
No.
Still a significant growth.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is also because at the same time the legislature made a pretty significant investment in our ANOCA and our community behavioral health hospitals to bring up the number of beds and staffing. So you've got two things going on. You've got one that's taking the amount of money spent in that area down because we shifted it into a new budget activity, and then you have an investment in new staff, and so they're playing against each other, which is why it doesn't turn out exactly as like a $44 million decrease.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is that projected going forward, that investment that you made, or is that a one-time spend on facilities, or it's been staffed up and will continue to be that large?
Ms. Kotsky?
Madam Chair, Representative, that was an ongoing investment because we brought up new beds in our system and we staffed those appropriately, and so you'll see staff costs that actually sometimes grow in the out years, particularly in the forensics and in mental health, because the staffing complement came on over time to provide those services.
Okay, thank you. Yeah,
thank you. Representative Munson, one of the big issues around here over the last few years and continuing, in fact, is that you may have heard in a lot of communities, people with mental health crises were kind of stacked up in hospital emergency rooms. It's become a really huge problem where we've got people in jails who have severe mental health problems who are being held in a jail because there's no place to go. And this is our state's facility where we have, where we treat the most severely ill people. And so I think that this was an effort to take the pressure off some of these other systems. Now, I don't think we have been completely successful at that, but I think that's what you're seeing here. Am I correct, Ms. Kotsia? That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Yep, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, let's continue.
Okay. The next slide looks at the FTs, the physicians, again, by the same. You'll see community-based services has the most FTs because we have so many homes across the community to serve clients in the community. They have the most FTs. Then the mental health and substance abuse, again, this is Anoka and our community behavioral health hospitals. Forensics is in St. Peter, sex offender program, and direct care and treatment operations. This is a snapshot of 2018. If we go to the next slide, you'll actually see the trends, and you're going to see the same thing repeat itself, right? One thing I forgot to mention, but about 85% of the spending in direct care and treatment is on personnel. So the vast majority of what they're spending is on the personnel that provides services to people and runs that program. So you see the same things you saw in that trend. Unlike our other programs, when you saw the trend on expenditures, you see the same trends in the FTs. Because when we came to the legislature to ask for money, most of that funding was for new positions to bring up additional beds to deal with different crises that we've had in the state to address issues in this population specifically. And then you also can see those FTs break out to your earlier questions about the operations, that you see that 18 FTs then turned into 224 because we broke them out of that bottom section and made them their own bar on the graph.
So it looks like we're at the end of a section here.
Yes.
So any additional questions from members? And, you know, this won't be, of course, your only opportunity. I see a few puzzled looks, and believe me, you know, after being on these committees as long as I have, I still don't understand all this stuff. But, you know, we're going to have other opportunities to understand it. And hopefully as we bring bills forward, we'll have a little refresher on the section and what we're talking about so that we can put it in context. So, you know, it's don't despair if you feel a little bit lost. But, you know, if there's something that these folks can clear up for you, you know, you can ask now or you can always ask offline as well. Okay. Please continue.
Madam Chair, next we're going to talk a little bit about our grant spending. These are the direct appropriations I shouldn't say direct appropriations in all cases, but these are the funds that we get to, we issue grants to or award grants to counties, to tribes, to nonprofit organizations to deliver services on our behalf. And this provides just gives it a little bit of an overview of our grant spending. If you want to see the total amounts of grant spending, I'd refer you back to this document here. This shows by budget activity the different grant programs we have and the amount of spending from each grant. And as you could see from looking at that, most of our grant spending is either from the federal government or from our general fund, with a little bit coming from special revenue funds. But going back to the slide, our total grant expenditures in fiscal year 18 was about $1.14 billion. The largest area of grant spending was in nutrition and housing, about 41%. This includes our SNAP program.
which provided about $431 million in nutrition assistance in fiscal year 18 to over 400,000 Minnesotans. The next biggest areas are children and community services grants. That's 13%. These are community, these include child and adult protection services and child welfare and child support enforcement as well. We also have about 12% of our grant funds go to behavioral health services. These include adult mental health grants, children's mental health grants, and substance abuse disorder services. And then,
excuse me, Mr. Greenman, Representative Haley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you clarify how much of SNAP is federal versus state?
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, it's 100% federally funded.
Okay. And that's why it's called a grant, even though you forecast and project how many. That's why it falls under the grant section, I'm presuming?
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, it's a grant because it's just the way the federal government accounts for it in their system and distributes the funds to the department. It's through a grant program. And we grant the fund. We grant the funds, or the funds pass through us to the people who are receiving the services. It's a bit of a gray area, you know, whether that's a grant or a program. It's but in this case, we call it a grant.
Thank you. Can I ask a follow up, Madam Chair?
Yeah, please.
So we saw a significant reduction in utilization of MA, which is a good thing if people are succeeding in a strong economy and being able to better provide. Are we seeing a similar reduction in SNAP utilization?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, yes, we are. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are, what the percentage looks like, but we can certainly get that for you. We can follow up with you on that.
I would be interested. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And Representative Haley, it's a great question because you would think SNAP is kind of, it's a forecast program in the sense that, you know, whoever shows up and meets the criteria gets on the program. So it is kind of interesting that we call it a grant. Of course, since it's 100% federally funded, it would also be confusing to put it in with our forecasted programs, I suppose. But that is a really interesting thing that you have noted here. So thank you for that question. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a quick question. How many FTEs are created within DHS through administering the grants? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I don't have the answer to that question. We can certainly look into that as well.
Yeah, Representative Grunhagen.
Just one follow-up question. How much of the general fund grant expenditures are ongoing versus one-time grants expenditures?
Mr. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I would say the vast majority are ongoing. For the most part, the legislature, for the most part, decides, I mean, unless they're federal grants that have its particular end date. In the case of the general fund, the legislature would sort of dictate whether those are ongoing grants or one-time grants when you appropriate the funds.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Greenman, just to close the circle on this, with the SNAP funding, does the federal government also pay for the administration of the program or just the actual benefit?
Madam Chair, they pay for the administration as well.
All right, thank you. Okay, please continue.
Okay. Just a couple other comments about this pie chart showing our grant spending. This is our all funds spending on grants. I would just also point out the child care includes our basic sliding fee program, which served about 6,700 families per month in fiscal year 18. Unlike the MFIP child care program, our basic sliding fee program is not a forecasted program, so it's a grant program. And then lastly, our employment services, which are mainly funded with TANF dollars, provide services to break down barriers to employment. In addition to funding MFIT, that's the primary way in which TANF dollars are spent, is through employment services. I thought this might be an interesting slide to show in comparison to the last one. This shows our grant spending by general fund. So you can see the difference. If you look at the difference in the pie charts, you can see the largest areas now in grant spending are in the areas of children and community services and behavioral health. And whereas you see nutrition and housing and employment services are a smaller share of the grants than they were on the previous page, because so much of the funding for those grants is from the federal government. So you can see where the state is investing money is in things like child protection, child welfare, and then also in behavioral health services and also disabilities grants.
And Mr. Greenman, just to, for clarity, so here again we're talking about, this is just the grant section, $376 million in fiscal 2018. Again, it's a relatively quite small part of the overall budget, right? So we're looking with a closer and closer lens at a really small part of the budget. In terms of, I don't know if you're the one that could answer this, but some of the activities that are in these grant, that we're doing here with the grant funds, we're also doing some similar activities through, for example, Medicaid, right? I mean, they're different. So, for example, I noticed that, aging and long-term care, 9% of the grant expenditures. We do a lot of our aging long-term care through Medicaid waivers and even our Medicaid state program, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So do these grants represent some sort of special activity? I mean, how would you explain why they're in the grant rather than in our regular forecast program?
Madam Chair, I'd probably have to want to rely on somebody who's got more expertise in this, but I would say the main reason would be because it's either not a service that's covered by one of those forecasted programs, or it's for a person, for an individual who's not eligible for those programs.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Please continue.
Okay. I'm going to start talking a little bit about the forecast, and I wanted to just make two points quickly. One is, for the first time in November, we produced a DHS executive summary and trend data on our forecast. I'm happy to send you all a link. I'm hoping it's really helpful, and I'd love any feedback that you have on it. We had not produced a document like this previously, and we're hoping that it makes the forecast a little more understandable for people when we do produce that, and kind of explains what changed in the DHS forecast. So I wanted to mention that. And I also wanted to, we've been mentioning a lot about decreases on our programs in the forecast. And what I wanted to point out, that some of them are actually decreases, but some of them are a decrease in what we thought was going to happen. So, for example, maybe we thought that the enrollment in families and children was going to grow by 4%, and it grew by 3%. That would appear in the forecast as a decrease, but that doesn't mean that there aren't more people on the program. So you're going to see that more when you go through these. I just wanted to make sure I said that so that people weren't expecting enrollment and costs to go down because there are savings of over $700 million in the forecast. It's that compared to what we thought was going to happen, it is less. And a lot of that is driven, as Mr. Greenman mentioned, by the economy. Both in our MA program and in our cash programs, we're seeing less people than we thought we're going to enroll in those programs, enroll in them. And you're also going to see that we're seeing a few more people enroll in Minnesota Care, which would probably indicate to us that their income is rising, and so that they're eligible for a higher income program. Okay. So this is the November. We issue a forecast in both November and February of every year, and an in-session forecast to reflect any changes that are made. So this is now we're going to look at just the forecasted programs. Mr. Greenman looked at the grant programs, and we're looking at the forecasted programs. And as you can see from this graph, the vast majority of the forecasted programs are in MA, medical assistance. So you see anything, any of these bars that start with MA, long-term care, MA, families and children, MA, those are all MA. And they make up about 88% of our total spending in forecasted programs. 31% of that, about 31% of that, is spent on long-term care and home and community-based services. And we're going to break that down more in later slides. About 20% is spent on MA basic care. That's your regular basic health care, not in a facility or a long-term care facility or in your home or community on a waiver, but it's your general health care for elderly and disabled. 37% is spent on MA for families and children and adults without children. This is mostly the expansion population of the Affordable Care Act. And then only about 3.4% is on Minnesota Care or BHP, the basic health program that we run here in Minnesota. The rest includes MFIP, our cash assistance program, child care, housing supports, and chemical dependency. I wanted to note that about two-thirds of all of our general fund spending in the forecast is for elderly and disabled individuals for basic care and the long-term care services together. So that's where we spend the majority of our forecasted cost. So this is a slide I like to bring out because I don't think everybody understands how the breakdown of the costs and the enrollment works. So this is all funds. Total expenditures for MA in state fiscal year 2018 were $12.5 billion. That dark blue section on the right that says $7.2 billion is actually spent on the 177,000 people in elderly and disabled. So about 57% of total MA expenditures are for about 16% of the total MA population, which is the elderly and disabled. And most of that money, about 60% of that $7.2 billion, is spent on long-term care services. And we're going to look at that more in slides in another section. The two groups, the adults without children and the families and children, the light blue and the green, the combined enrollments for these groups in fiscal year 18 was about 925,000. And we spent about $3.3 billion for the families and children and about $2 billion for the adults without children. And again, what I want to mention about that $2 billion, this is all funds. We received 94% federal matching in fiscal year, well, 94 and 95%. It changes because it's a calendar year for that group on for in federal funds fund that group. It's a very small general fund investment, which you'll see Mr. Greenman is going to present more on that.
Representative Munson has a question.
I guess looking at the chart, it would appear that the children's and families spending versus enrollees is, I don't want to say it's a great deal, but it's a significant, it's a smaller amount per person than looking at the adults without children ratio. Mm-hmm. What at a high level, is it because the federal match is not there for those individuals, or what explains the high dollar amount per person spending in that category?
Madam Chair, Representative, the part of this, what you're seeing, this is all funds, so this doesn't have to do with what federal share it is. But part of what you're seeing is most of that section, the green section, families and children, are kids. And so the cost for a child in the medical field is lower than adults. They don't always have to see a doctor as often. I'm going to actually defer to Mr. Greenman because he's going to present really specific information in the next section on the adults without kids and the families and children and the cost per individual in there. At least I'm pretty sure he is going to. So he'll probably get more into here, but that at a high level, that's why children cost less.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm finding it, remember, what we have in front of us doesn't have color on it. So it makes it a little bit challenging. That's why we keep looking up at the screen to see what's the green section, you know. But I think I've seen this kind of information. Whoa.
Sorry. No more questions for me.
Oh. I've seen this kind of information presented a little differently with, you know, with a, more like a bar chart where you've got the number of enrollees and then the, I mean, there's just different ways to present it. But I think what we're seeing here is that a lot of our money, and I think you said this before, a lot of it is spent on pretty high-need people, the elderly and disabled population. I mean, the spending there, we're talking about a whole different kind of service than we're talking about with a lot of people with health, just health care. So I'm going to call on Representative Brunhagen. We are just about out of, we are out of time here, but I'm going to give you the last question, and then we'll hold the rest until next week. So please.
I could hold it till next week.
Okay, make a note on your.
Yep.
And then, I have, I'm going to call on Representative Moran. You have an announcement before
thank
we
you,
break here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, as Chair of the Health and Human Service Policy Committee, I would like to invite you to attend an informational hearing that we're going to be hosting at our in our committee next Friday, January the 25th, from 1 to 3:30 at the Grand Casino in the Mille Lacs Convention Center. All right, so that's next Friday,
so the 25th. The casino.
Right, we're going to the Mille Lacs Convention Center. So we're inviting representatives from the Minnesota Native Tribes and the bands to share their important insight about our state ongoing opioid crisis. So we're going there to hear from them directly. I'm really excited about that, but I really want to encourage and invite you to attend if at all possible. So the committee has reserved a coach bus that will begin loading in front of the state office building at 10:15 on Friday the 25th, and we will depart at 10:30. So this information will also, it should have already be in your email, in your inbox. So please take a look at it. Let me see. It's an email at the top of this meeting. So, right, you should have the information in your inbox right now. And if you have any questions or concerns and want to reply right now, please see my legislative
committee
assistant.
Oh, and
my committee assistant.
Yes, and thank you very much for helping us today. We're still doing musical committee administrators, and Chris is Representative Moran's committee administrator. Right.
So this is Chris McCall. So keep that mind, keep that date in mind, Friday the 25th. And really, we really need responses as soon as possible, so please let us know. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, members. With that, we are adjourned.